Session number 788.
Oh yeah,
General.
Captain Brian Motherfucker with the first of the Patriot Carrier Officers Station.
General Kenneth Cooper.
General Cooper, real story.
We had the Crossley Armour Car, a four-wheeled, relatively light armoured car, and then we started to be issued with the Guy, six-wheel armoured car, which is a very much heavier vehicle. Slightly thicker armour, rather cumbersome, particularly on the cud roads, where you have narrow embankment roads dropping down into rivers, and if you got to the edge, if you weren't careful, that extra weight could cause you trouble by breaking away the bank, and then unfortunately you had to be, you were not nearly so maneuverable. They were more comfortable. By that I mean you had more room within your turret. But I think on the whole, for our internal security work through the bazaars, the Crossley was a better vehicle, being smaller than the Guy. Quite often in the Guy, with these bazaars, you took away their awnings and trappings, and that upset them a bit by accident.
This work you did in Delhi, tell me a little more about it. What was the sort of customary routine?
Well, you always had one, the armoured car company had one section was always on duty for 24 hours, so that you could, you were never allowed out of the fort whilst you were on that duty, so that you could turn out for any trouble in a matter of minutes. You exercised both on sand tables and out by showing the flag to patrol the streets. You didn't do very much. You kept out of the old city of Delhi, except when you were ordered down there for trouble. You didn't do any exercises there because it might have upset the natives. So you did your exercises in the suburbs, really, and pretended it was the city.
How frequently did these troubles occur, and what sort of form did they take?
Well, they used to take, it always happened in the hot weather. The winter, seldom. In cold weather, the winter, but the hot weather, it would start off with the police would be some troubles, either communal, you know, Hindus versus Muslims, or of course you had also it was the time of Gandhi and civil disobedience there, and when the police felt that it was getting out of hand, or that a crowd of a few thousand were collecting in a place and being worked up by some agitators in the background, that the presence of some armoured cars behind the police, not going into the crowds, behind the police, might have its salutary effect. And so you go out with a civil commissioner who's an Indian, usually, in fact always, I think, in the car, because you had to have him, because if you had to open fire, you had to get him to sign a piece of paper that the situation was out of hand, and you had to open fire.
That makes rather a difficult constraint to work under.
Well, it's very difficult, but if I may say so, by the time we got outside the fort, the commissioner, we'd revolved the turret several times to see it was properly working, and of course some of the soldiers had some big heavy boots of gunner, and he might stand on his hand or his feet, because he was an extra man in the turret, and we found no difficulty in him signing the piece of paper before you got there, but he kept on to the piece of paper. He didn't hand it over to you until trouble. Fortunately, I was never in that position.
How effective were the armored cars in these kind of crowd control operations?
Mainly morale, both for the civil police and as a detriment to the populace or the mob. You had to be very careful you didn't get involved with them too closely, because you're very vulnerable sitting inside a tin can and a howling mob outside, and you don't know whether to shoot or not shoot, and they can jump out over it. However, we did, about this time, they developed a form of electrifying the armored car, so that if a native touched the armored car, he got quite a shock, which deterred him, and that soon spread.
Do you remember how that was done?
Oh, it was a very simple thing. From the battery, and you had a trembler coil, and you had a chain that went onto the ground to earth it, and as soon as he touched the car, you've got the circuit.
Did the cars have any other limitations operating in the old city conditions of Delhi?
Well, they had the limitations that you, if you did come up against the road blocked or the crowd blocked, of course, you couldn't turn around. So you had to be very careful. You didn't get too involved in the situation so that you could back out. And you had to become very, drivers. We did a lot of trading in reversing, because you simply couldn't turn around in those narrow streets.
Were there any particular operations in Delhi that you can remember that are of interest? You could perhaps tell me as a little story? Once it's taken.
No, I don't think so, because we never had, as I say, we never opened fire. We were often called out, either by ourselves or in company with the infantry, whom we had a company in those days. It was a company, I can remember, the Gordon Highlanders, who were on their feet, and of course we supported them. But I can't remember any interesting particular incidents.
Was there a special drill for coordinating the armoured car units with the infantry units?
Oh yes, we were always practicing together.
What were the drills?
Well, the drill was that the infantry covered the armoured cars so that the mobs didn't get too close to you, and you covered the infantry so that they didn't get overrun by the mobs themselves. They covered them by fire, that was, if necessary. If not, they could also get in under the shelter of the armored cars, if you might term it that way, come close to the car, and you withdraw or not, as the case may be.
In your work with the armored car unit, did you feel that you had reasonable resources, reasonable backup, reasonable facilities, as compared with RTC units, say, in the UK? Or was it a problem, the supply lines being so long, did that create problems for you?
No, I don't think so. You had all your course, bears and the normal administrative organisation, the distances were greater, admittedly, but so you, from bases and workshops, but you carried a few more spears than you would if you were closer. No, I think there was not very much that I noticed in that line. We seemed to be adequate. We had a reasonable allocation of ammunition for training, for shooting practice, and I don't remember my vehicles being off the road for lack of a spare part. There might have been occasionally, but nothing serious. Oh, it was a great life out there with armored cars. I remember it was a great training, especially for a young officer, because I was able, 1 year, or in fact 2 years, I think, to take out my section of 5 armored cars. We went off for, I think it was a month or 2 months, touring the States, seeing these Rajas in their palaces, and one was entirely on one's own. One had to, as a young officer, you had to make your own blunderbuss about rations, petrol, spare parts, and as long as you didn't interfere or worry the company commander when you got out there and cry for help, he'd let you go. And there was no, of course, no trouble in the city when you might be recalled. And that was a tremendous experience. You went out with your chaps, and gosh, didn't the soldiers like it too? And you took a little gun with you so you could do some peacock shooting or peahen shooting and sport.
There was an RTC training school in Delhi, wasn't there? Ahmednagar.
Ah, no, that wasn't Delhi. The training school, the equivalent to Bovington, was at Ahmednagar.
Mm.
Ahmednagar, which is in central India. I never went there.
I see, fine. After a year in Delhi, you went to Lahore. Where was your headquarters there?
In Lahore, in cantonments, which is outside the city. And of course, the cantonments, and it consisted, the cantonments was a military cantonment. Purely military base with barracks, hospitals, for both the British Army, which I think consisted of one infantry battalion, might have been more, and an armored car company, and then there were several Indian Army regiments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have any interesting experiences in Lahore?
No, I don't think so. We had in the summer, you moved up to the hills, because it was very hot in Lahore. In the summer, it would never go at night time below 100. And of course, and so you left down a section for any troubles, and the rest of the company, that's that section, went up to Dalhousie, which is in the Himalayas. And of course, that was a lovely, cool, and a great experience there. You didn't do much training from an armored car point of view, but you did individual training of shooting and that sort of thing, but mostly sport.
In Lahore itself, were there similar crowd control duties to be carried out, and how did they compare in type and frequency with those in Delhi?
There was no difference in the in one's drill and action with regard to crowd controls in the horn. The bazaars were the same, practically the same. Distances were greater in that cantonments was, I think it was about 5 miles out, whereas in Delhi Fort was, you were in the bazaar in a quarter of an hour. But the hall, it was further out. The drill was the same, crowds were more or less the same. Frequencies, I should say about the same, because they were, at that time we were getting a bit more of Gandhi. And indeed, in 1 year, I know we never got up the hills at all. No more serious. Again, we never, in my experience, we never had to open fire or anything like that. But owing to the distance, you were more often than not may well have to stay out all night. If the crowds hadn't really dispersed or were likely to form up again if you moved back. Whereas Delhi, there were more quick forays in and out than in the hall.
You mentioned these long training expeditions in which you were involved as a single section. What were the purpose of these expeditions?
The purpose of the expeditions were to train you to act on your own, train you to administer yourself, to rely on yourself, and that goes for your other, I had another officer, and then of course your sergeants, NCOs, and men, because there you were all on your own, and your fitter, he was on his own, he had no senior chap to go to if anything went wrong. And general reliability and self-reliance, initiative, and leadership.
What did they teach you about your capabilities and your limitations?
Well, they taught you, in fact, that if you came back not having had a major mess-up, then at least your organization was good, that anything that had, whichever something did go wrong, you were able to overcome it. And if you made a nonsense of it, well, there was your limitations, and you soon told about it.
What kind of nonsenses or limitations were revealed? Can you remember any specific examples?
Nothing serious. At times, you had a bit worried. You might have been running out of water, or you might have been running out of petrol or a particular ration. And you had to adjust your rationing or put them on short rations till you picked up the next load.
It would, of course, be much more testing on the durability of your cars than operations within Lahore and Delhi, for example.
Oh, very much more so. And and that, of course, depended upon the upon your section in good maintenance, and if anything went wrong, repairing it. And that you brought the right spares with you.
And moving on swiftly to your next posting, you went to Abbasiyah in Egypt in 1935. What was the RTC set up at Abbasiyah?
The RTC set up there was that they'd converted. They had, I think it was two armored car companies. Never sure before I got there. And those two were formed about, I suppose, 34, or it might have been 33, perhaps 33. They were formed into a tank battalion. And when I got there, they had got these medium tanks. And it was a tank battalion in Abbasir Barracks. It was just the same as a tank battalion at home. Same organization, same equipment. Vickers medium tanks.
Of course, you'd work with Vickers mediums in the UK. How effective were they under the different kinds of conditions?
Oh, far harder, of course. Out there, of course, you had to compete and with the sand. And that, of course, brought excessive wear because it's a very hard sand and your things wore out quicker. You had, of course, you're always experimenting with different types of filters because they got chugged and some would let in a different type of sand. Because as you know, sand is either round or some of it is it's like quartz. You couldn't see it except under a microscope. You don't know it. They were always sending us out new filters prevent them getting into the engine because they wore out the engine so quickly. With regard to working in the desert, your distances, of course, were greater in between your individual tanks because it was open country as opposed to close country, open desert things. Drilling and that was more individualistic because you were at greater distances and weren't under such control. The dust kicked up by the tracks, of course, was appalling. Your third difficulty, of course, was map reading.
Why was that a difficulty?
Well, because you've got no... in the desert, there are no landmarks. It's just sand and dunes and no woods or anything like that. And, of course, no maps.
How did you deal with these kinds of problems?
Well, except you had maps, it's marked an oasis or something like that. But so you had to do it by compass, navigate on compass. And if you were with a section, you put a navigator into a four-wheeled vehicle, and he went ahead because you couldn't be jumping out of a tank with a compass, and you can't use the compass inside the tank because of the magnet, all the metal around it. And so you had this, you had your navigator, and you took station by him. It was usually a battalion navigator. I think it was end of 35. There was this trouble in Abyssinia.
Can I just keep you on the compass for a moment?
Yeah.
Did you make any efforts to develop a tank compass?
I was going to say it was when this Abyssinian trouble came, and we were quickly moved up to Mirza Matru, which was out in the desert, edge of the western desert. For patrolling the Italian frontier. And it was while we were up there that another officer and I, a chap called Bobby Jenkins, who was a very intelligent, indeed he was one of these one of the first varsity commissioned officers. We got down to it and developed what we called a sun compass.
How did you set about that?
Well, we cut out a piece of cardboard and got a piece of steel like a knitting needle, stuck it in the middle, and as the sun went round, we marked it off, having already marked out the time, 24 hours, on it. And it was a very cutcher bit of equipment. And then we experimented to see whether it would work.
Kind of experiments?
Well, we experimented. We fitted it on a tank, and we went out into the desert, and we also had a chap in a vehicle with an ordinary compass, and he followed us, and we went by our sun compass, and then he would every so often, he'd come up and say, "Now you're a bit off here, or you're a bit off there," or, and in general, we proved that it was workable. What we couldn't prove, we didn't have time, was whether it was any good with the moon. In fact, we failed on that. We just didn't have the time to go and experiment with that. But anyway, cut a long story short, eventually we persuaded the higher-ups that this was the answer, or an answer. And our things were sent back to British troops Egypt in Cairo, and they got down to it and eventually produced a proper sun compass, which was called an Evans-Lerm sun compass, which was a properly made metal compass which you fitted to each tank. Eventually, they made it sufficient for each tank, but to begin with you only got some up. And they were used very considerably after that as the means of navigation.
Apart from the sun compass, were there any other kind of on-the-spot experiments, innovations, modifications that you introduced in the light of your practical experience and your assessment of your own needs?
Oh, I don't think no major. I don't think there were any major things. Of course, all during this time, we were also experimenting with they were sending out, I think it was about that time, we got these Austin 7s with purely the chassis and two seats, no windscreens, nothing on them, and wheels developed so that you could hook on a hook and four men could lift it up and get it out of the sand. They were the forerunners of course, the Jeep. These Austin 7s were purely experimental, came out from England, and proved the fact that this was a worthwhile machine, with reservations in that the Austin 7 wasn't high-powered enough. They'd have got to have a bigger engine so to get more power per weight.
Egypt had a great reputation as a centre of innovation. I think, for example, they were experimenting with wireless in Egypt long before they tried out experiments in the UK. So I thought maybe you had seen some of these other kinds of experiments and developments.
Well, there were, of course, the wireless thing was going ahead all this time, and improved models of wirelesses were coming out and that sort of thing. But they weren't, in my time, they weren't the first. Or it wasn't the first time that a wireless had been used, as far as I was concerned.
The 35 Abyssinian crisis, I think, created quite a stir in Egypt. In fact, there was an additional RTC battalion sent over to Egypt. Do you remember that time in any detail, the sort of reactions and what people were expecting and what steps you took to meet what you thought to be the threats?
Well, of course, it was the when we went up, in 35, we were the first to get up there. We were then followed by, I think, I'm not even saying the 8th Hussars, whom we'd converted from horses to, or been converted from horses to Ford trucks with machine guns on. And whilst we were up there, then they formed the Mobile Brigade. And the first tanks came out in 36 and joined us then. I think the 11th Hussars came out too. And indeed, and we were up there till the beginning of 36, the spring of 36, and then we moved back and were taken over by the threat had dropped a bit then.
Mm. When you say up there, you mean up at Mersa Matruh?
Up at Mersa Matruh, for the frontier.
While the crisis was at its height, what were you expecting to happen, and what sort of operations, manoeuvres were you carrying out?
Well, we were really only patrolling, and we never reckoned that anything would happen ourselves up there. We never felt in the slightest degree in danger or that there was likely to be war. The Italians, as we patrolled the frontier, where they got their wires down from Saloum down to the south, and they were all well dug in, well behind, and it didn't seem to us that they were ever going to move out of their positions behind there. We did do quite a bit of training with the Navy who came in, to the extent of of Mersa Matruh is some distance, I can't remember it now, 100 miles from